Okay, good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the remote hearing of Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. And I think the first item is to take the roll. So if you can unmute yourself, and Ms. Hansen will take the roll. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright?
Good morning. Present.
Thank you. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling? Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Noor?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto? Representative Rasmussen?
Present.
Representative Robbins? Representative Sandel?
Present.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, members. We have a quorum. Representative Fisher, would you like to move the minutes from February 4th?
Yes, Chair Schultz, I'd like to move the approval of the minutes from our meeting on the 4th of February.
Thank you. Representative Fisher moves approval of the minutes from February 4th, 2021. Any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, please unmute yourself. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes from February 4th are approved. So members, today we are going to be hearing two bills, and I see that we have Representative Cleaborne with us, and she's going to present House File 338, Direct Care Service Corps. And then we're going to hear from Representative Morrison on her bill on recuperative health homes. I just want to let members know that Wednesday we will be hearing from the agency. We're going to get an overview of non-emergency medical transport and our legacy IT system. So that's for Wednesday. And then Thursday we'll be hearing additional bills. So just to introduce this topic, many of you already know this, but we have an incredible shortage of workforce in healthcare, particularly for PCAs or direct support professionals. It's been a problem for many, many years, and we need to tackle that problem. I just met with many people in the long-term care services and support industry this morning, and they made clear that especially now during this pandemic, they have a need for more workers and staff to care for older adults and our most vulnerable in Minnesota. So we have a real mandate, a priority to try to address this need and to provide services for those who need them to live and to do activities of daily living. So it's vital. So I know Representative Cleaborne will be telling us about her bill to try to address this workforce shortage. And we need many more of us to tackle this problem and come up with creative solutions to get young people interested in these careers and to show our community that we value their services. And I know it is personally very rewarding, these positions, to care for others, but financially it's not rewarding. Families cannot support them themselves as individuals or feed their family on these low wages. So we need to tackle this problem. So Representative Cleaborne, welcome to the committee. I'm going to move House File 338, and it's going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance bill. So Representative Cleaborne, I don't think we have any amendments for your bill. Is that correct? No amendments. So I moved the bill to get it before the committee. And we're going to turn it over to Representative Cleaborne to introduce her bill and give us information about it. And I believe you have one testifier, and then we'll open it up for questions for members. So Representative Cleaborne, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed. Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Ginny Cleborn, and I am here today to present House File 338. 338, as Chair Schultz mentioned, is a Direct Care Service Corps pilot project. It would be established in conjunction with Health Force Minnesota at Winona State University, and they will develop the curriculum and oversee the project. The pilot sites, the intention is that they would be both in the seven county metro area as well as greater Minnesota, so that we would have a full idea of what the needs are in each of the greater areas in our state. And then, of course, we want to make sure that any pilot program that we fund at the legislature has a report so that we can see that the dollars that we're spending are serving needs that are trying to be addressed, as well as whether or not we should go forward with the project. It's very important. With me today are, I have two testifiers, if time allows. We have Diane Drost, who is the person who brought this idea forward and has been a true champion for individuals with disabilities in need of direct care services, and also Kirk Ingram. And I think Kirk will be the first testifier today. Are you shaking your head, Kirk? Is that yes? Yes, he will be the first testifier today. So I would ask, Madam Chair, that you please turn the floor over to Mr. Ingram. Thank you.
Okay, welcome, Mr. Ingram. If you can introduce yourself to the committee and let us know your affiliation and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Representative Chair, for having me. My name is Kirk Ingram, and I'm affiliated with the AIN. I have a C4 vertebrae that I was injured back 5 years ago. So I'm essentially a quadriplegic and have paralysis from the chest down. During my hospital stays, my family and I were educated on paralysis, how to do daily cares, and how to interview personal care assistants, PCAs. So I would have assistance with my daily tasks of living when I moved back home with my wife and daughter. We actually spend many education hours on how to ask the right questions to find the right PCA fit. However, I can attest we have never had the luxury of really interviewing PCAs because we've accepted any and all interested parties out of sheer necessity. The reality is not many people are interested in PCA work, especially those with extensive needs like a quadriplegic like myself. So the burden rests on the family members to pick up the slack. When we talk about the needs of someone with paralysis, we tend to use words like daily tasks of living, bowel and bladder program. These activities are extremely intimate and personal activities. It requires insertions of enemas, catheters, showering, changing clothes, listening to personal conversations about healthcare, as well as benefits. A PCA becomes a member of the family because they are, for all intents and purposes, an extension of me. This we are asking of someone to do for only $12 an hour to do these tasks. We have never used our full allotment of PCA hours, which is 15 hours a day, not because I don't need them, but because we can't find enough people to without our PCAs going over 40 hours max per week, as overtime is not allowed. We have had advertisement open for PCA position since April 2017. In that time, I have only had one PCA apply for work for me. PCA shortage is not a temporary shortage. Some suggestions to encourage people to become PCAs include a student loan forgiveness program or increasing benefits such as paid time off or healthcare, even part-time work. Without a solution, people with paralysis and other disabilities are not going to be able to live in their communities and will default to much more expensive nursing homes. I know of several instances where people are suffering severe injuries and even fatalities because of the lack of PCAs. So I encourage you to acknowledge the PCA problem as a devastating issue it has become and to make a concentrated effort to finding a solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ingram, for your testimony. Thank you for being with us today. So the next testifier is Diane Drost. I might be saying your name incorrectly, Diane. So please introduce yourself for the record and let us know your affiliation, then proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I am a member of Women Staying Strong, and we are bringing forth this bill for the creation of a Direct Care Service Corps pilot program. Women Staying Strong is a group comprised of women who are supporting members with spinal cord injuries. I have also provided the committee with a report that was presented to the Olmsted Subcabinet, which includes the development of Service Corps as a high priority strategy in order to expand the worker pool. One of the strategies included is the development of the Service Corps through partnerships with colleges, universities, and or private partners. I hope you all had a chance to take a look at that document because it lists many other strategies that we are working on. My daughter, Sam, experienced a severe spinal cord injury while boogie boarding after her first year of college. Currently, Sam, like many others, has spent countless hours advertising for PCAs with little success. As a result, her father and I have provided much of her PCA cares. This is a common thread in the spinal cord community. In fact, many families have completely given up looking for help and are doing it themselves. Despite Sam's horrific accident, which resulted in her disability, she has completed college with a double major in math and economics. She is employed as a senior analyst at Target headquarters and is completing her master's study at St. Thomas. Sam has quadriplegia, but it does not make her stop her from completing her goals. She's very determined. The only thing that will stop her from completing her goals and living in the community is the lack of caregivers. We cannot let this happen to her and to others like her. We have had in the past many college students that work with Sam as PCAs. They were capable and caring. They were interesting to be around. They were fun to be around for her. But that source has kind of dried up, in part due to the fact that they have to find work which pays much more due to the high cost of college. We came up with a solution in hopes that we could expand the workforce to include a great number of college students. We really are suffering out here. We have to expand the workforce. And we know that there's students that would come back to work for us if we could offer them incentives such as scholarships and other incentive type programs that Valerie will be talking about later. Please, if you would support this pilot program and let our family members continue to live in the community.
Thank you, Ms. Strost. So Representative Claiborne, did you want to follow up the testimony or do you want to open up for questions?
I would like to say that Valerie Defoe is with us this morning and she is at Winona State. And I would ask her just for time and brevity, if she would just be available to answer questions if people have them about the program itself. The thing that I would like for the committee members to know is today hearing Kurt and Sam's story are just two. There is an entire Facebook page devoted to what do I do if my PCA doesn't show up today. I sent to many of you earlier this year in the summer asking for your support for this bill. The stories of has anyone spent the night in their wheelchair? Because going to bed with a simple cough can mean your death if you don't have a PCA available to turn you over in the night and clear the mucus. We have a growing number of young individuals who are financial analysts, who are engineers, who are graphic designers, who are in dire need of this service. We have seniors, we have children who are in dire need of these services. I'm asking each of you to say to yourself, if my child were to go out today to do just a normal daily activity and end the day with quadriplegia, what services would you want available to your child? What services do you want available to your parent? These are the questions that families face every day. And I'm asking you to support this bill, help us start this pilot program. Let's see if we can encourage people to become PCAs. Let's see if we can elevate together the profession of PCAs. And then it has an added benefit as well. It's helping students who may be pursuing a health career to understand the needs of people who have a dependency on another for their daily living activities. This is truly a human services bill, and I ask for your support. I open it up for questions now, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. We have a question from Representative Albright. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions for Ms. DeFore, if she is available. Ms. DeFore, my first question is the Direct Service Care Service Corps pilot program. You detail financial incentives that would be offered to individuals that would participate in this program. Could you elaborate in terms of what incentives that would entail and how long they would last?
Valerie DeFore, welcome to the committee. State your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Valerie DeFore. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Health Force Center of Excellence. Health Force is one of eight centers of excellence within our Minnesota State system of colleges and universities. The Health Force role is to do whatever we can on behalf of our system to meet workforce needs in the healthcare field. In reaction, Representative Albright, your question, the amount of the incentives is still to be determined based on actually the funding available. I think we have created a concept that can be easily flexed to include more people, fewer people, more incentive payments, you know, less incentive payments. The vision that we have related to the model is that we would get college students working as PCAs, and at each semester there would be an incentive payment made if the person had, you know, met certain criteria, which we would still develop as part of this project. That criteria would certainly include, you know, number of hours worked, satisfaction, of the person receiving services, and I'm sure some others. And then there would be that incentive payment. And then that incentive payment, what we'd like to see is that the next semester, it actually goes up so that it's also a retention model where we could get college students to work as PCAs for 1, 2, 3, 4 years, which will also, we think, go a long way towards increasing quality of care, satisfaction. We believe this could even result in reduced expenses to the healthcare system if persons with disabilities are cared for and receive what they need at home versus having to go to the emergency room or having to go to actually live in a care center. So, we think that this pilot could help us study that model and really, you know, make a difference if it plays out the way that, you know, we hope it will.
Thank you, Ms. DeFore. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple more questions. Ms. DeFore, I note that the Health Force Minnesota has been part of the MNSCU system since 2005. Could you elaborate or expound on terms of what have been the results over the last 15 years in terms of emphasis on Health Force Minnesota?
Ms. DeFore?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, members of the committee. Yes, yeah, so the Centers of Excellence were established in 2005 by the legislature at that time. Health Force was one of the original four centers that were started. Since that time, work that we have done is very broad, it's very varied. And let me just give you a few examples. Sometimes the challenge in the workplace is we don't have enough people enrolling to be whatever it is that we need. So we have done scrubs camps throughout the state of Minnesota over the last, 15 years. Not this past summer, of course, because of COVID, but in 2019, we had over 1,000 high school and middle students attend a scrubs camp to learn about health careers, to learn what that might look like for them, to find a good fit for them. We talk about nursing and physicians a lot, and they're very well known in our society, but we also take that opportunity at Scrum Camps to talk about all the allied health fields, including working in long-term care, in-home health, as a PCA. So that's one kind of bucket of work that's taken place. We have also done things like supporting our college and university nursing programs with accreditation needs. We've had an expert on my team to support, you know, those efforts across the state. We have done a lot of work in the long-term care space for workforce development, including creating an online, very robust and engaging toolkit for nursing assistants. And we really upped that game over this past year as that we realized, oh my gosh, we need a lot more nursing assistants during COVID. How are we going to train them safely? Well, to transition to online training was one of the answers that we brought forward that has served the state very well. We run Minnesota HOSA, which is a health occupation students organization, kind of like the FFA for healthcare. Again, to get students interested and prepared to be successful in the healthcare field. Gosh, there's probably all kinds of other things I could share with you on that, and I'd be happy to actually just send you, maybe the committee, some of our annual reports so you can sort of kind of see the breadth and the scope of the work that we do.
Thank you for that, Ms. DeFore. We would welcome that report to the committee. You can just send that to our committee administrator and she can forward it. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. DeFore, that sounds like a very robust program. My question, though, I guess creates another question of my understanding, and this is where maybe you and I might go astray, is it sounds to me like your recent answer that this is more of a public relations awareness program versus actually creating a workforce from the perspective of generating people to be and create PCA. So is the intention to drive more towards one versus the other? I'm just trying to, if you could refine your answer to maybe help me understand if it is more of a public relations awareness program that you're talking about, or actually, quote unquote, turning out more PCAs.
Ms. DeFore?
Yes, Chair Schultz, Representative Albright, members of the committee. Let me try to do that better for you. Let me try to make a better answer for you. Our vision with the Direct Care Service Corps is absolutely to create more PCAs, to have more people working as a PCA while they are in college. Some of the work that we do absolutely is related to exposure to health careers and health occupations. That is a part of our work as well, but and there would be some of that actually focused in this Direct Care Service Corps. We would want to, at the pilot sites, you know, publicize this as an opportunity for students, but the end goal is more people working as a PCA while they're in college.
Thank you, Ms. DeFore. And I'll just add that there is reporting requirements in Representative Cleburne's bill that looks at the success and the impact of this program. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. With a $500,000 one-time appropriation, presuming that these PCAs might earn, say, $25,000, if that, I'm just using that in roundabout terms as an annual salary, you're looking at generating about 20 new positions. Would that be correct?
Ms. DeFore?
Chair Schultz, Representative Albright, members of the committee, I do not believe that the participants in the pilot project would be working full-time as PCAs. I think they would work part-time, probably anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week. So we would hope to have, you know, significantly more than that number, Representative Albright. This bill has come forward over the last several years, and we can develop the budget very nimbly based on the actual funding. So, for example, if we were fortunate enough to receive the requested $500,000, we would create a budget and a project that had a very significant number of PCAs, you know, working and receiving those incentive payments.
So, Representative Albright, I think there's some confusion that they would get reimbursed through the rate setting formula through various public programs for their actual wages. This fund, I believe, and Representative Cleburne can clarify, provides additional incentive payments. Representative Cleburne?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to say also to answer the representative's question, Representative Albright's question. The Minnesota state system will tell you that in best practices, they do not encourage students to exceed more than 15 hours a week so that it doesn't interfere with their abilities to also do their studies. So that's one piece of it. And this is a stipend program. It may not necessarily be an hourly wage program as well. So those parameters, I would trust to Ms. DeFore to know what is best for that university system in keeping with the practices that they currently have and paying other students to do work.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a final question for you in terms of is the intention for this committee to move this bill forward today, or is this being laid over?
This is being laid over. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, Representative Cleburne, for bringing this bill forward. First, you know, many of you know, I've said before in my work life outside of the Capitol, innovation and creative solutions are a big part of what I do with my team. And I really applaud this bill as a really innovative way to close a gap where we see a real dire need, right? We have, the need is just so great. And I can tell you that the individuals that are impacted by this, you know, are folks who are smart and vibrant individuals in real life, and many of them have found themselves in unfortunate circumstances. There's a gentleman that goes to my club out in Minnetonka who uses the water therapy pool, and he was one of those typical active, fit, young men jumping off cliffs and whitewater rafting, which is actually how he ended up in his predicament. He was thrown from a whitewater raft. And so these, again, are really vibrant, smart individuals that we're talking about here who really need access to this care. The question that I have for you, though, in terms of this really great solution is that I hope that Ms. DeFore could speak a little bit more to the individuals who would likely be candidates for this program. What is the career path that they're on? And how would this experience working as a PCA really enhance not only their educational experience, but also really add a vital service to these individuals?
Ms. DeFore?
Yes, Chair Schultz, Representative Bonner, members, thank you for that question. I believe that anyone would benefit so greatly from being a PCA while they're in college, no matter what field of study they're in. However, I do think any of our healthcare students studying to be athletic trainers or a nurse or a respiratory therapist would absolutely benefit from working as a PCA while they're in college. I think it will not only inform their professional life and maybe even the choices that they make. We could impact that, but it will also just raise the awareness of the dire needs and of the needs that people with disabilities face. And I think that's not anything to be ignored in this process. We would definitely reach out to health science students, but any student, I think, would reap great benefits from this. I know as we've been working on this for the last couple of years, you know, we've heard or we've talked about what if you're a person who's super interested in music and that's one of your passions. Well, maybe that, okay, we could pair that person up with a music student and, you know, they could build on that relationship and that's nurse or that music student, you know, would be a terrific PCA for, you know, that individual. So I think across the board, it would be beneficial. We would certainly, I think, see a lot of benefits, though, with our health science students who might choose this path.
Madam Chair, may I address the question?
Representative Cleaborn?
So imagine, Representative Bonner, if we have engineering students who decide to work in this program as a PCA, they will figure out ways to develop better ramps, better chairs, better lifts, better whatever. Sam is with us today, and she helped develop a better coat. So there are, you know, you could be a textile design major or something like that and figure out better ways to help serve people with all different types of abilities. And I think in my own experience as a legislator, working with these dynamic spinal injury individuals, people who've had spinal injuries, they have taught me so much more. I will never look at a sidewalk the same way. I will never look at a handrail the same way. I will never take a shower without thinking about their needs. These are ways that we enrich civilization by seeing each other's needs. And I think it's a really great question that you ask. Thank you for that question.
Thank you, Representative Cleaborn. And I don't know if you heard the story on Minnesota Public Radio this last weekend about a young individual who helped design sneakers that you didn't need hands to put on. So they were, they didn't have laces, and I believe the person worked with Nike. So it was a really interesting story. Representative Bonner?
Thank you for that. And I just want to close with, you know, thanking the testifiers for coming today and sharing their experience and what that meant to them. And I can tell you one of the other reasons for my question, and I'll be quite frank, is that many of you know my mom is a nurse, 43 years in the system. And before she started nursing, there was no formalized degree for nurses. So when she started in the emergency room, one of the things that she credits greatly to her experience is that before entering the emergency room at HCMC, which is a way to trial by fire, she had worked in a number of assisted living facilities, performed very similar services to what we're talking about here. And she spoke very highly of how that service was invaluable, not only for having empathy for her patients, but to really understand the ins and outs of her job and where she was headed. And I certainly appreciate and understand also the Representative Cleaborn mentioning, you know, this could lead to other innovations in engineering, better wheelchairs, better products for folks. And I think that there's an intersectionality of all of these issues that can really lead to enriching people's lives. So I'm really thankful for the innovative program and for bringing this forward. Thank you for the testifiers, Ms. DeFour, and to Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Representative Cleaborn. There is a fiscal note for this bill, and I'm sure, Representative Cleaborn, you may want to mention that. And then closing comments. I don't see any other questions from members. Oh, just wait, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before Representative Cleaborn talks about the fiscal issues, I just wanted to thank the testifiers, Mr. Drost, Mr.
Mr. Ingram, I believe.
Ingram, thank you, and others. The area of, spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury is very, it's a personal one for me. I've worked on it for a number of years. And Representative Bonner, you are correct that, you know, innovation comes in a lot of different forms, not only by the folks that have continued to endure these situations and make their lives better, but unfortunately we don't have a governor who sees it the same way. That innovation also comes through research grants, and he has totally wiped out the $3 million in his budget that would go towards maintaining that hope and vision for innovation from the medical community. So I encourage this going forward, but with the reality that we also are suffering from a very deep fiscal hole. And Representative Cleavor and I wish you the best in navigating the competitive arena for funding as we look at balancing the state's budget.
Thank you, Representative Albright, and thank you for the work that you've done in this area. Representative Cleavor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to you, Representative Albright, I do invite you to work with me on this task. I would love for you to be on the bill with me. The fiscal note is it is a one-time payment of $500,000 in fiscal year 2022. You all, the committee members have before them the fiscal note, and I would direct you to page 2.2 of 3 on the fiscal note, where it talks about the bill description and how the money would be divided. And $25,000 of this money would be allowed to be used for the administrative portion of this bill. I would be happy to answer further questions, but it is our intent that the majority of the money go to pay the stipends or the students who would be participating.
And I believe there's a fee for the agency of 15%, which is $10,000 in each year of the biennium, so $20,000. So
that is correct,
total,
Madam Chair.
The fiscal note is $520,000.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Albright, your hand is up. Not sure if you have another question.
My apologies. I've just not read.
Okay, thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Cleavorn, any other closing comments?
Well, I would just like to know the members of the committee to know that I did reach out to SEIU Healthcare, which is one of the largest providers of PCAs in our state, to ask if they would be willing to support this legislation, and they are in fact in support of the legislation. So we would have really good partners in working together to make this program a success. And as I said earlier, we would really like to have enough funding to make sure that we could pilot in all four major north, south, east, and west in our state so that we can have a better picture of how well it would work in different communities across our state. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do ask for your support. I realize the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and I'm always available to work with you on issues related to PCAs. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn, for championing this legislation, and thank you to all the testifiers for coming today and sharing your experience, Mr. Ingram, and your idea, Ms. Drost, and your expertise, Ms. DeForest. So thank you for that. So with that, I'm going to lay House File 338 over for possible inclusion in our Human Services Finance Bill. Thank you. Okay, our next bill on the agenda is House File 256. So I make a motion to move House File 256 before the committee. Representative Morrison, this is a bill that I've heard a lot about. I'm excited to hear more, and it looks like you have a testifier, but if you want to introduce yourself to the committee and start speaking about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, I'm Representative Kelly Morrison, and I'm pleased to bring you House File 256, which is a bill that would direct DHS to work with stakeholders to develop a health home model that would provide effective and much more cost-efficient care for our state's homeless population. Under the Affordable Care Act, the federal government allowed states to develop two health home models to coordinate care for complex patient populations. To date, Minnesota has developed one, the behavioral health home. A health home model under the ACA integrates physical and behavioral health and other services and supports for higher need, higher cost Medicaid populations. By better coordinating care and linking people to needed service, health homes are designed to improve healthcare quality and to reduce costs. This bill simply directs the Department of Human Services to request federal grant funds to establish recuperative care services for people experiencing homelessness as a health home model. There is no cost to this bill. These types of models are used throughout the country and often are known as respite services. A number of for-profit HMOs around the country have developed these models because they save dollars by letting people heal and recuperate in a healthy, safe, and clean environment after a healthcare event rather than cycling in and out of the emergency department. I ask you all to think about the last time you or a loved one was hospitalized or underwent a surgery. Imagine you had an emergency appendectomy, for example. Remember that ride home from the hospital. I personally remember a couple of those after surgery, that ginger, getting into the car, cringing at each bump in the road, and then going home to recover and having a spouse or a partner or loved one maybe bring you soup, make sure your medications were in order, set up your follow-up appointment, and make sure that you weren't moving around more than the doctor ordered. Now imagine that you didn't have a home to return to after being in the hospital. You're well enough to be discharged from the hospital, but certainly still unwell enough that staying on the streets or in an overnight shelter will make recovery nearly impossible. Without proper nutrition or being able to rest, without a safe place to store your medications or wound care supplies, and having to move around in the community with everything you own during the day, taking care of yourself is incredibly difficult. And that's where recuperative care can come into play. Last year, I toured a shelter in downtown Minneapolis where Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless is providing care to patients experiencing homelessness. The Hennepin County Healthcare for the Homeless program works to decrease barriers to accessing healthcare by bringing critical services to the homeless population by locating clinics within emergency shelter and other services. The current recuperative care services in the shelter are very limited and covered by small amounts of dollars from partners. This particular bill deals only with the service portion of medical recuperative care services. It doesn't address the shelter or the housing part of the care. This health home model will ensure that patients have the services they need while having a place to stay off the streets to properly recover, improve health outcomes, and prevent avoidable returns to the emergency room or readmissions to the hospital. A number of health systems and nonprofit groups are supportive of this legislation, and I believe you have letters of support in your virtual packets. I do have a testifier with me today, Dr. Danielle Robertshaw, who is the medical director of Hennepin Healthcare for the Homeless, here to share her extensive experience related to this model. And I believe DHS is here also for any technical questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. I had to check to make sure where the bill was headed, so I'm going to officially move that House File 256, Kelly Morris, or Representative Morrison's bill, be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. So that is the motion, and we will go to your first testifier. Dr. Robertshaw, please introduce yourself for the record and state your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you all so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Morrison. As mentioned, my name is Danielle Robertshaw, and I'm a physician, and I currently serve as the medical director for Hennepin County's Health Care for the Homeless program. And I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As a physician, I've actually been working in homeless settings for now 21 years, amazing, and my experience very much reflects what decades of research has confirmed for us. The patients that I serve who are homeless are much more likely than their house counterparts to get sick at younger ages, often present in acute and preventable crisis situations relating to chronic health problems, and they die younger. The average age of death in multiple studies for those who are chronically homeless is around 47 years, despite an average life expectancy of nearly 80 years in the United States. This 47 years is equivalent to the US's life expectancy in the year 1900. Homeless shelters are certainly ill-equipped to serve the medical complexity of the clients walking in their doors. Hospitals are often overwhelmed trying to find safe discharge plans when someone is medically stable and ready to leave the hospital. And patients are rarely in a place to prioritize recovering from illness when faced with the competing priorities of daily survival on the street or in an overnight shelter. Recuperative care is a model that's been around for over 30 years across the country, and I like to think of it as a win-win-win. It serves to close gaps for shelters, healthcare systems, and makes patients a much better place for recuperation. Currently, there are a few small programs connected to health systems in the state, but they are not reimbursed by Medicaid, and that often the limited funding makes them difficult to sustain. Basics in a program for recuperative care include a safe and recuperative environment with 24/7 access to a bed, 3 meals a day, and support services where someone can stay for a period of time to recover and get well. Years of data tell us that having a time when you can get adequate sleep, nutrition, and put your feet up and feel safe is an important and vital part of recovery. For many of us, we have a safe place to go when we leave the hospital, as Representative Morrison mentioned. We're lucky and fortunate enough to have family or friends to care for us, healthy food to eat as we recover, and a safe, warm environment. For those in our community without this, recuperative care provides that safe space and support, allowing someone to be able to focus on health and receive connection to ongoing services through care coordination of their medical care, their mental health, substance use treatment, and housing navigation. Recuperative care can decrease seemingly insurmountable pressures for a number of systems. Coming from the health system perspective, I'm excited about better health outcomes, but also in connecting people to lower cost appropriate medical services such as primary care and decreasing the use of costly acute care services such as calling 911 and ambulances. All of these have shown to be the benefits of recuperative care. I encounter patients every day that would be so much better served by recuperative care than a revolving door of acute care services. I have a lot of patient stories I could tell, but I always come back to this one. It sticks out in my mind as just so instrumental in how we have shaped our views. So one patient I met about 2 years ago now, his name was John. He was new to the shelter clinic on the day we met, and he came in with a request for Tylenol for some muscle pains. Seemed pretty simple. And then we started talking. I asked about the cause of his muscle aches, and his story was anything but simple. He was in his early 40s and had been diagnosed with terminal cancer 8 months earlier. He was divorced, had two young children that lived with their mother in a neighboring state. He'd been homeless for several years despite having a steady but low-paying job. And between the pain from his cancer, the chemotherapy side effects, he had not been able to work for the last few months. The social worker at his cancer doctor's office was working on getting his name on a list to get into a free hospice facility, but there was a wait list. So he slept in an overnight shelter, went to the library during the day with all of his belongings to try and sleep, and rarely had energy to access meal programs around town or make it to all of his doctor's appointments. And when he became dehydrated and overwhelmed by pain and his chemo side effects, he would force himself to go to the emergency department. He'd been admitted to the hospital two of the three times he went within the last few weeks. He was at the point where he and his doctor were talking about stopping the chemo. He recognized he was dying and he had just two goals in life. He wanted to get off the chemo and then hopefully feel well enough, at least briefly, to travel and visit his children. And second, to have his name come to the top of the hospice wait list so he wouldn't die on the street. I often reflect back, struck by this man who was younger than me and was making end-of-life goals and decisions without even a place to call home. His goals were not extravagant and should not have seemed so basic and yet fraught with so much uncertainty. I think about what it would have meant to be able to offer him a recuperative care bridge to hospice, but all I had to offer him was the Tylenol he had requested. Again, there's an unfortunate number of stories I could share and support the need for this adequate, accessible, and sustainable recuperative care model that would better serve Minnesotans who are ill and experiencing homelessness. I appreciate the many partners, including individuals, other health systems, DHS, and stakeholder groups who've contributed to this work and provided the opportunity to bring this bill forward. I hope you will support the use of health homes to create a Medicaid benefit that will help us pay for the vital care coordination and wraparound services that are not currently reimbursable. But are foundational for a successful program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Robert Shaw. I don't have any other testifiers. If members have questions, we have DHS available. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I do have some questions with regard to the model and maybe I'll hold on those because I'm a bit perplexed by the manner in which you put this bill together. And so I'll be direct. Why does the bill, your bill, direct DHS to seek funding to develop these services rather than just direct them to develop the services and or simply just put it in the services into statute? Why are we just looking at developing the model or directing the commissioner to develop the model? It seems like we're not going about this in a normative manner.
Representative Morrison, would you like to direct that to the agency?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll defer to DHS, but I believe it's because we have to do, I'll let DHS, they'll answer better than I can.
I'm not sure who's here from DHS, but if you're here, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. I'm not hearing you. I don't know if Ms. Grom or is available just to answer that, or Mr. Burdick. There you go. We still can't hear you, Mr. Burdick.
My apologies, Madam Chair. Still getting used to the virtual environment. I believe I've got a colleague on the line. We were just getting ourselves technologically sorted out here. So I'll let my colleague, Vimbai, jump in on this one.
Please proceed.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead, please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay, good morning. This is Vimbai Mansura with DHS. And thank you. And so the question was in regards to why this bill is directing DHS to seek funding rather than just starting with the model. Part of that is there are planning grants available through CMS, and so this would be an opportunity for us to seek that funding to then be able to work with stakeholders. With our experience with developing behavioral health home services, there were quite a few resources needed to bring up that model, and so that's part of the reason why we're seeking that federal funding to support the development of this model.
Thank you, Ms. Mansura. Ms. Representative Albright?
The bill also, thank you, Madam Chair, the bill also stipulates that DHS cannot move forward on developing any other services. Is that commensurate with what Ms. Mansura just said about the model being created first? Or I'm really trying to find out if this is just for the planning purposes, and then what would be the next step after that? And maybe Representative Morrison has accomplished that in other legislation, or what would be the next step after we secure or solicit and secure funding for the model itself, if I'm correct, to develop it?
Ms. Mansura? Oh, you're muted. We can't hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. The double mute every time. thank you. Part of the reason, there is funding available for different models, of course, and for states to support planning for health home models, but we are specifically wanting to focus on this population, understanding the need. My apologies. As well as, so the next step in this process would be, of course, working with stakeholders to develop the service standards, to develop rate development, and to develop the infrastructure to support these services and building upon what's currently in place, of course.
Thank you, Ms. Mansura. Representative Albright?
Just one final question for Ms. Mansura, but what would be your expectations in terms of one solicitation of the grant itself? Is this something that would be provided and enacted by DHS in the current biennium, or are we looking at the next biennium for completion of this task itself? And that would conclude my questions, Madam Chair.
Ms. Mansura or Representative Morrison?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to Ms. Mansura. Thanks.
Okay. Ms. Mansura?
Thank you. This task specifically would be completed within this biennium. However, the next step would be for the next biennium in terms of developing the standards, rate, and so on.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Bonner?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And first, I want to say thank you to Representative Albright for helping clarify some of the specifics of the program for us. A couple of my questions were answered in that, so I'll just come at this from two different pieces. I actually come from the technology world and spent 3 to 4 years of my life working for the largest healthcare company in the country. And the program that we worked on, the pilot that we created, was specifically focused on hospital readmission prevention and the small ways in which we could use that to help bring down costs overall to the healthcare system. And one of the big things that we found is that really basic, small things could have a direct impact on the ability to bring down those costs to the state, to the healthcare organization, to prevent spreading that cost on to members and their cost of healthcare, and a number of various issues. And the reason that I know a little bit about this as well firsthand is, again, I mentioned my mom is a nurse at that county, and the population at the county is rather diverse. And she noted, this has been a frequent topic of conversation at our dinner table for the 40 years that she's been a nurse, that we had a lot of patients who, for whatever reason, found themselves in unfortunate circumstances and were homeless. And patients with really severe issues that needed to be addressed. And I remember the conversation around how they could do the best they could to keep them as long as possible and was permissible, knowing full well that the probability is that once they were released, they had nowhere to go, no way to take care of the care that they needed to get better, to prevent being readmitted again, which is extremely costly and expensive. And particularly when we talk about things like uncompensated care, those often end up in that bucket as well. But really, at the end of the day, this is really about doing the right thing for humanity. My mother talks often about a particular case of a gentleman, an Indigenous gentleman, who had very few ties to his family and was in the cardiac ICU and is extremely, extremely sick, and because of his condition, very delicate. But he also had served as a veteran overseas and served his country with great honor. And she went through and took the time to personally spend copious amounts of time and hours to find a place for him to go because the system was just not built to accommodate this particular situation. And, you know, she actually won an award for her work with this gentleman. And the one thing she always said to me is that while she was honored to get it, she was extremely disappointed that going the extra mile to make sure that a patient had good continuity of care and better outcomes was somehow something worthy of an award. She looked at that as an integral part of her real job. And so I think that having a model where we can do this is really, really fundamentally important and a pathway to do that. And again, this issue has spanned decades. And I know that ER staff, urgent care staff, ICU staff will tell you that this has been a heartbreak for them for years and years. So I thank you for bringing the bill forward, Representative Morrison, and for all of the folks, Ms. Mumbai, who have done work behind the scenes to move this forward.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. I'm not seeing any more questions from members. I want to thank Representative Morrison for being an advocate for this bill. It is such an important issue, and to have services available for those who are unsheltered or homeless, to make sure that they're not repeat visitors to the emergency room, to make sure they're getting the continuity of care they need. This is, we need to pursue this and see how we can pay for it, but put together a model that works for the people in our state. So with that, Representative Morrison, do you have closing comments? And then we can move to the vote.
Madam Chair, thank you. You said it very well. Recuperative care will decrease emergency room visits and hospital readmissions. It'll help prevent the need for higher cost components of medical care, and it will provide a safe place for people experiencing homelessness to heal. I urge your support. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Okay, members, I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 256 to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. And I believe we have to roll call this vote in this virtual environment. So, Ms. Hansen, are you ready to take the vote?
Yes, of course.
Okay, please proceed.
Chair Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Albright?
Aye.
Albright, aye. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Burkle, aye. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Knorr?
Aye.
Knorr, aye. Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Novotny, aye. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Robbins?
Aye.
Thank you. Robbins, aye. Representative Sandell?
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Schumacher? Representative Schumacher? Well, Madam Chair, that's 18 ayes and a possible abstain.
You're muted, Representative Schumacher, if you want to hit star six. Okay, the motion passes. Thank you, Representative Morrison, and to the testifier for your background information on this bill and how it can improve people's lives in Minnesota. So you're on to the next committee, Representative Morrison, with your bill. And with that, members, I just want to remind everyone that to just be cautious when you're talking about other members or the governor in this case about what you imply from the bill, the budget proposal that the governor put together. We don't want to infer people's how much they care about certain issues because they can't fund them. That we cannot infer that from the governor's bill, and especially in this situation when we have a budget deficit and we have to balance our budget as a state and make really tough decisions. So I just want to caution members not to make those broad comments when others are not here to defend themselves. But thank you, members, again. Wednesday, we'll hear about NEMT and our IT systems. So I'm looking forward to learning about those issues and a conversation. But with that, we are adjourned. Thank you, members.